Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, vaping is exploding amongst teenagers. But up front, Pennsylvania is losing one congressional seat and one presidential electoral vote. The state will now have 17 of each. It wasn't unexpected, but preliminary population figures from the 2020 U.S. Census count confirm that Pennsylvania's population has been growing slowly, especially compared to other states like Texas or Florida. But what does it mean for the state going forward? Will Pennsylvania have less clout in Washington? Will the state still be considered important in future presidential elections? To break it all down is our guest today, Dr. G. Terry Madonna, political analyst and a senior fellow in residence at Millersville University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Madonna, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott, and as always, thanks for having me.
If you have a question or comment, like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Terry, as I said, this was not unexpected, but how significant is it?
Well, obviously, numbers matter. I mean, if you have a substantial delegation to in the federal House of Representatives, what that means is you know, your membership will increase on committees. If you serve longer, and you know, obviously, if you have more people, they might serve longer. That means chairmanships, sub-chairmanships. So, now, you know, you can have a large delegation in which you have a bunch of people there who aren't very significant, if you get my point. But I think you'd rather have more members in the House than fewer members in the House. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And what's interesting about Pennsylvania, in the 1920s, Pennsylvania had 36 members of Congress. And as you and I chat now, as you accurately point out, we're going to go from 18 to 17, which also means a reduction in our electoral college vote. And so there are a number of significance here. As you raise the important question, what does that mean in the House delegation in terms of significance? Significance for not just the nation, obviously, but for the state. It also, number two, we were the most visited state in 2020 by the presidential candidates. If we continue to drop electoral vote, what does that mean over time? I think the one vote moving into 2024 is not likely to make a big difference. But, you know, over time, it could make a significant difference.
All right. So let's talk about all those things. As you point out, that numbers do matter. Just having one less congressional seat, does that translate to Pennsylvania having less clout?
I think probably not one. I mean, over time, again, that's what's really significant and equally important, I think, is going to be the battle over redrawing the congressional districts that is likely to end up before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, before it's all over. The current boundary lines were drawn by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in 2018, I should say, because the court ruled the boundary lines 10 years ago. These get redrawn every 10 years. Historically, traditionally, and those boundary lines were ruled unconstitutional. And in 2018, I'm talking about the 2011 boundary lines, and that made a significant difference in terms of the party differences. There's another aspect, party differences. That's a huge, huge aspect to the boundary line, the boundary lines that are going to get redrawn this year.
And let me just point out to our listeners, we're going to have a conversation that will sound very political, will sound like we're talking politics, and you know, hopefully your eyes don't glaze over. But remember that Pennsylvania voters, Pennsylvanians will have be impacted by anything that happens here. So that's why this is a significant conversation to have that will have an impact in probably most households in Pennsylvania. So let's talk about some of the political ramifications, Terry. Democrats in Washington in the House of Representatives now have a 5-seat advantage. That's close. Right. That's tight. As you know, and you've pointed out many times with your sense of history that you bring to this, that in an off-year election, meaning that the first election after a presidential election, the party opposite the president usually picks up seats. There already are some retirements announced on the Democratic side. Is this an opportune time for Republicans to pick up at least one seat in Pennsylvania, making that 5-seat difference even closer, or Republicans retaking majority in the House of Representatives?
That's extremely important. As you and I speak right now, it's 9-9, 9 Republicans, 9 Democrats. In 2020, all of them, all of the incumbents won re-election. So the boundary line, the boundary lines that are going to get redrawn are truly significant, and we're not yet sure if any of the current incumbents will run for another office next year. We have Connor Lamb, who's a House member out in the southwestern part of our state in the 17th congressional district, indicating he might run. We have Madeline Dean in the 4th district. She's in Montgomery County, basically a Montgomery County seat. She might run. So, you know, we could have members of our congressional delegation not seek re-election running for, you know, the Senate next year, since Senator Toomey has indicated he's not going to seek re-election. And so that will have a big effect on, to some extent on seniority, although these two are not long-term members of our House delegation. But that will play big time into how the districts are redrawn if there's no incumbent in that office. But make no mistake about it, the smaller the number of people you have, I think it just goes to show that you have less opportunity. I'm not saying you can't have a small state that's significant. And the House races, the 5-seat difference that you accurately point out right now in the House, and the fact that the incumbent president's party tends to lose seats far more often in the midterm election following their election than not, all of this plays into national politics, as they say, big time.
So the speculation is that the seat that will be eliminated will come from one of the areas of the state that is losing population, or where the population isn't growing as fast. That would mean the Southwest, Northeast, or North Central Pennsylvania. Those seats are all held by Republicans right now. Now, that would seem to favor Democrats, but some of those conservative voters in those districts will be moved into districts now held by Democrats, which could make those districts more competitive between Democrats and Republicans, right?
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, how the jostling that will go on will be big time to add people and subtract people. I mean, look what happened in 2018 when the Supreme Court redrew after the 2011 districts were ruled unconstitutional. They redrew the boundary lines. You know what happened. The Republicans had a 13-5 edge in our congressional delegation, 13-5. And that began in 2012. It was 2014. It was 2016. The Supreme Court redrew the boundary lines in 2018. And we're now at 9-9. You get the point. I mean, look at the significance that made in terms of the party delegation. And part of the, you know, in the party delegation situation, 9-9. And so typically, if we get people resigning, And I'm not saying Madeleine Dean and Connor Lamb are going to. I'm saying it's been rumored. There have been reports, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That also gives them wiggle room to massage the loss of a district by getting into the situation that these incumbents will no longer have to be protected. And the people, the state, here's what's fascinating. The state legislature draws the boundary lines. They do it in the form of a law. It has to go then to the governor for his signature. We have a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor. You got that?
Yeah.
And so that could lead us to a big impasse that could end up, you know, into the Supreme Court. Back in 2011, the last time the boundary lines, were redrawn in the normal 10-year, after the normal 10-year decennial census was issued in 2011, the lines were drawn so sharply that that Republicans took this 13-5 edge, which they maintained until 2018. So this all really matters significantly in terms of the money that lawmakers are able to bring home, not just for their districts, but for their states. There's where numbers begin to matter.
You've been bringing up the two members of Congress with Connor Lamb and Madeleine Dean. Now, those are two Democrats. Lamb's district is one of those areas of southwestern Pennsylvania where the population is not growing. Dean's a little bit different, coming from the Lehigh Valley, southeastern Pennsylvania, where population is growing. One that you haven't mentioned, though, is Dan Muser. Dan Muser, Republican congressman in northeastern Pennsylvania, again, an area where the population is not growing as quickly, and there's speculation that Muser may run for governor. So that would be another member of Congress in a district that where the population isn't growing. So that is a possibility as well. We've had a couple listeners ask, Terry, if you have an opinion on which districts will be consolidated or eliminated?
Oh, we just don't know. I mean, I tend to agree with you. I think it will be in what I call rural and small town Pennsylvania, largely because, as you accurately point out, the population in those parts of the state is not growing and even registered a loss. The total population increase in the census was a little more than 13 million, that's the total for our state, 2.4%. It's a lower increase, 2.4% increase than we've seen in past decades. So yeah, it could come. Yeah, I would surmise that's where it will take place. But remember the Republicans control the Pennsylvania legislature. And I'm gonna let that sink in. And this is an extraordinarily political process. It is hugely political. And so you can't rule out that they could reconfigure some of the districts in the Southeast or up in the Lehigh Valley. You just can't right now. And I've been through this for 40 years. You just can't rule out almost anything that's likely to happen. But you would think it would come out of rural and small town PA up in the Northeast, maybe in the T somewhere. You know, if you skip the Southeast and Southwest and go up through the heartland and then run across Route 80, or if you will, the New York border, that's the T as we refer to it. You can't rule out that it would come somewhere in the T as well. I just don't think Republicans initially are going to agree to that.
Well, okay, Republican majority in both the House and the Senate in Pennsylvania, but a Democratic governor over the past year. I mean, they cannot agree on the color of the sky. I mean, if one says it's blue, the other is going to say it's another color. I mean, there is no agreement whatsoever over the past year between the governor and the Republicans in the House and Senate. Just last week, the caucuses, you know, there's a 5-member committee that is supposed to draw up these boundaries. Each caucus and a fifth member, which is, you know, agreed upon by the other four. They couldn't come to an agreement. No surprise there. So the Supreme Court will now name that member. What's this all mean?
Member. Well, remember, we're now talking about the drawing of state legislative districts, the 203 state House seats and the 50 state Senate seats.
Right. Yeah, I should have made that point clear, clarified that.
Yeah, that's different than Congress. And historically, they have been unable because the four members, two Republican leaders and two Democratic leaders from the House and the Senate, the fifth member would chair the commission. And historically, they've been unable to, they did some interviews, I forget how many, 20, 30 interviews, maybe even more, to try to pick the fifth member. And no surprise, they couldn't agree. So the Supreme Court will name the fifth member. And right now, and as you and I talk, the Supreme Court is controlled by the Democrats, if I can put it that way. There are more Democrats on it than Republicans. But historically, the commission has been concerned about incumbent protection almost more than anything else. And the difficulty there hasn't been as great as it's been in the whole state legislature choosing the congressional district boundaries. And remember, the whole legislature is not involved in the state legislative redrawing, just the five-person commission.
Terry, we're almost out of time.
It is.
One thing that we've touched on it, but wanted to talk a little bit about the electoral votes. Pennsylvania loses that one electoral vote. You said earlier you still think that the state will be some a swing state in that, you know, with those 17 electoral votes, we still have, we're amongst the top five in electoral votes. So we'll probably still get a lot of visits by presidential candidates, just not as many. Is Pennsylvania still going to be a prize with those electoral votes, a prize for presidential candidates?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about it. As I indicated before, in 2020, we were the most visited state in the union by far. President Biden opened his campaign in the state, ended his campaign in the state, came back to make a speech dealing with fracking, in which he said he supports fracking, played up his roots. In our state, I don't think there is any doubt that Pennsylvania will remain one of the top six, seven most competitive states. We've got our state, we have Minnesota, we have Michigan, we have Wisconsin, we have Arizona, we have Florida, we have North Carolina, and now we have Georgia. So, you know, there are 50 states, make no mistake about it, but when it comes down to the prize, meaning the competitive states, we're talking about six, seven, eight states at the most.
You know, Terry, I'm just curious. One final question. I'm curious about this. You know, Pennsylvania's Republican delegation in the state Senate and in the state House, not all, but most Republicans signed on to a letter objecting to Pennsylvania's electoral votes being certified on January 6th. Eight members of the congressional delegation signed on to a Texas lawsuit and also objected to certification. Will that matter with voters going forward?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's going to matter in terms of who they vote for. You know, that will be decided by, you know, these individuals on their party affiliation, party support, and which candidate they end up liking. And remember, over and over again, President Trump referred to a stolen election, and you and I have chatted about this, talked about widespread fraud and distrusting mail-in ballots. And three out of four Biden voters voted by mail, two out of three Trump voters voted in person. And so there are bills now in the Pennsylvania legislature to kind of, you know, depending on your side of the equation that you're on, to deal with that. But there isn't any doubt in my mind that mail-in voting is here to stay. and there need to be some reforms made to it to give the public confidence in it, and also to make sure that there isn't fraud. There was not widespread fraud in all the examinations that took place. Widespread fraud. That doesn't mean that there wasn't some fraud, and it doesn't mean that there weren't technical mistakes that were made. The precincts were overwhelmed with mail-in ballots, which they couldn't begin to deal with until Election Day. I think there are reforms which the legislature can make that will make it work better.
And just to clarify, I think there have been 3 cases of fraud, all voters who voted for President Trump.
Yeah.
And also that, you know, none of these things would have made a difference in the outcome as far as who won.
Exactly.
Pennsylvania's electoral votes. Dr. Terry Madonna, political analyst, senior fellow in residence at Millersville University. Thank you very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. 1 in 4 Pennsylvania high school students report vaping in the past month. Every day in the U.S., over 3,500 youth start vaping. In 2018 alone, the number of high school students who vape nearly doubled. That's according to the American Heart Association. Many adolescents and their parents falsely believe the products are safe and don't realize that they can deliver higher concentrations of addictive nicotine than traditional cigarettes. To discuss this epidemic, Dr. Christopher Russo, Director of Pediatrics, Women and Children's Services, Medical Director for Quality and Innovation at WellSpan Health, Brandy Sheeler, School Social Worker at Red Lion Area Senior High School, and Nikki Maurer, Executive Director of the Community Health Council of Lebanon County. Thank all of you for being with us today. Brandy Sheeler, I'm going to start with you. You're a social worker at the School Social Worker at Red Lion. I use the word epidemic. Is it?
Oh, I 100% agree. It's an epidemic. I work with students on a regular basis, educating them on vaping and vaping products. And it just doesn't seem to make an impact. Many, many students are affected by it.
Nikki Maurer, why? Why are so many teens vaping? And I guess I should add the word, why are more teens vaping?
Thanks, Scott. You know, I think that, you know, like a lot of other substances that teens get into, there's some novelty to it. I do think that students believe that it is safer than smoking. And I think that they enjoy the flavors.
Yeah, that's I saw a poll that asked kids why they vape, why they started vaping. The flavors, that was one of the big reasons. The biggest reason was that they saw a friend or a family member start to vape. And another reason, and I didn't know this was a thing, they can be used to do tricks. What's that?
Oh, yeah. You know, with the rise of platforms like Snapchat and TikTok, you know, kids are making these little 10-second videos. And I would say that this started maybe, I'm going to go with maybe 5 years ago, where they found that with the amount of smoke that you can create with a vaping device, you can do all sorts of, you know, old fashioned cigarette tricks, you know, making rings or, you know, blowing different types of shapes. And I think it just got really popular on these little, you know, clips that they can make on social media.
Wow.
I just like to add, I don't think that's as popular as it used to be. Like Nikki said, I think this was more popular a few years ago.
Oh, really? It's a trend that has seen its time go by or what?
I think some of it has to do with just the devices themselves. And I think some of the smoke and the vapor you were getting were some of those less sophisticated devices a few years ago. They're getting sleeker and smaller, and I think some of them have less vapor. So I think it's not as common.
Yeah, one thing, Scott, that has become very popular nowadays is smokeless vapes, because they're much harder to detect in the schools.
And they look cool, too, from what I understand. Or at least the kids think so.
Yeah, Yes, there are a very wide variety of innovative ways that the kids can hide them and disguise them as regular looking products. Everything from USB drives to even something that might look like an eyeliner, you know, pencil.
Wow.
Yeah, so they even market different colors and skins and things you can put over top of the devices to kind of personalize it. So I would agree that the look is actually very appealing.
Dr. Christopher Russo, here's the important part, the health impact. I mean, it's not just like this is an annoyance that more kids are vaping. As one of our guests said earlier, you know, this started off, you know, I didn't realize that vaping only became came to be back in 2007. So it's only been like about 14 years. But there are many people, many kids who still think it is safer than cigarette smoking, which actually cigarette smoking has gone down. But vaping is not, is it?
Yes, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. So, you know, really, I think it's helpful to go back to the history. So vaping was really started as a way for adults to then, particularly adults with lung injuries, to be able to continue smoking, but in perhaps a more safe way. But I use safe in quotations because it is not safe. Although something can be safer, it is still dangerous. It's the equivalent, I'll say, you know, if you're driving 120 miles an hour down the highway, that's not safe. While driving 100 miles an hour down the highway, that is also not safe. Is it safer than 120? Perhaps, but it's still not safe. So, you know, it's one thing to mention importantly that when we talk about vaping, vaping is really just the technology. It's, you know, taking liquid or wax and heating that, and that creates a vapor that then can be inhaled. And so that could be a liquid that contains nicotine, or it could be a liquid that contains THC or marijuana. Now, we know we've seen in adults, but also in children, what's called a VALI, or vaping-associated lung injury. And that's where, because of the other additives that are in this liquid, whether it's acetate or vitamin E or other toxic chemicals, it actually causes long-term lung damage in children. And this is besides the known toxic effects of nicotine for the developing brain. The child's brain is still developing until the age of 25. And so a child who is exposed to nicotine early on is going to have long-term consequences for their development and health.
If you'd like to ask a question, make a comment, join in our conversation about vaping amongst teens, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Dr. Russo, you mentioned nicotine. Again, in the analogy you made was driving 120 miles an hour versus 100 miles an hour. Are you saying that there is less nicotine in vaping than in a regular tobacco cigarette?
Actually, just the opposite, Scott.
Really? Okay, so that's what I wanted to point out.
More nicotine in this, but when you are burning tobacco, there are about 7,000 chemicals that a person can be exposed to through the burning of that nicotine in a traditional cigarette. So a vaping experience or exposure is less, it's not 7,000, it's still an awful lot to them. But the amount of nicotine actually ends up being more. Now, from a pediatric standpoint, we have seen some injuries with children because these nicotine cartridges or refills are straight liquid nicotine. And children get, they will uncover them, discover them in a parent's purse or next to their nightstand and consume significant quantities of nicotine. And that can be fatal in certain circumstances.
These long-term lung injuries that you're talking about, describe them, if you will. What happens to the lungs of some of these children? And by children, I assume you're talking about kids under the age of 18?
Yes. And you know, sadly, we have seen in 2019, the latest data we have, that almost 4% of eighth graders had vaped in the last 30 days. That's eighth graders. And so we know that this is something which our children are being exposed to at an earlier age. What is discussed in the literature, and there were recent articles in the journal Pediatrics, which is from the American Academy of Pediatrics, they talk about the lung injury as being sort of an obliteration of the lungs. Sometimes it's called popcorn lung, and that is really to describe the radiographic appearance on a CAT scan or an X-ray of the distinctive type of lung injury that is oftentimes irreversible.
Wow. And there have been changes in the last few years in higher concentrations of nicotine, which makes vaping more addictive to these young people. And again, you know, that same poll that I referred to just a few minutes ago, there was a high percentage, like 40% of the kids who were polled there said there was no nicotine in what they were vaping. So they're unaware, or they've been misled as to this. And marketing is a big part of this. Brandi Sheeler, let me ask you. I mean, when you talk to some of these kids that have been vaping, how much does marketing, how much does advertising play a part in this? And how about, you know, their ignorance as to what is actually in these vaping products?
Absolutely. And I know marketing has been something that's been discussed for a while now. Red Lion School District is part of the Juul lawsuit right now. We're actually working on sending some data out for that. So marketing, we know it has been a huge issue. I think what I'm seeing right now is it's sort of and someone mentioned it earlier, the marketing right now is basically you see a friend, you see an older relative vaping, and then your curiosity is piqued, and then you decide to try it, and then there goes the cycle of addiction all over again. But absolutely, we know based on just, you know, research and looking at big tobacco marketing from many, many years ago, that it's just being repeated right now with the vaping devices.
Mm. Nikki Mallow, what about?
I just want to add to that.
Oh, go ahead,
Dr. Point. Wonderful point. I just want to add, Scott, that, you know, one of the things is really to have these discussions with, if you're a parent, to have the discussions with your teenager. At WellSpan, we really take pride in our primary care pediatricians and family medicine doctors to make sure we're asking the tough questions of our adolescent patients and asking with the parents. So I'll give you an example, Scott, that, you know, I had a child that I took care of in the hospital, and I primarily see children in the hospital. And I asked him, as I normally do, I said, do you smoke? Do you smoke marijuana, cigarettes, anything? He says, no. And I said, do you vape? He goes, no. Well, not really. He said, what do you mean? And he said, well, when I go in school, usually I'll go in the bathroom and someone will offer me, you know, to take a hit of something with a vape pen. So I don't really vape, but when I'm in the bathroom, I, you know, if someone offers me, I will. And so, and I say that, you know, because there really is a disconnect sometimes with children, right? And I mean this, you know, not as a pejorative to children. They're just thinking very linearly and factually to say, no, well, I don't regularly vape, so I'm not a vapor. I don't vape, but you still do vape from time to time. And that's where we're trying to really, as a healthcare system, really impact these children and get the discussion going.
So the distinction that young man was making is that he's only a restroom vapor rather than a social vapor out. Okay, I get it.
Yes.
Nikki Bauer, what about in Lebanon County? It sounds as if marketing, advertising, peer pressure, seeing other people doing all these things that we've mentioned. Have you seen that in Lebanon County?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we've been following this epidemic, I would call it, for a number of years. Our health coalition, as many of the health coalitions in Pennsylvania, follow the PAYS data, which is the Pennsylvania Youth Survey. It's where we get a lot of information about high school and middle school age students. It's given every 2 years by the state. We have 500 school districts in Pennsylvania, and you know, upwards of 420 take the survey every other year. And we have seen a dramatic increase in vaping starting in sixth grade. And so, you know, as a health coalition, you know, we are, you know, deeply concerned about this and have been working with our tobacco provider in our region for, you know, increased education, but also advocating with the school districts on, you know, their policies and how they're treating students with that are caught vaping. You know, something we were just talking about, the percentage of kids who don't know what they're vaping, and it is awfully high. One disturbing trend that I see in the data is that starting as young as sixth grade, you might see something like upwards of 60% of kids who are vaping don't know what they're vaping. And then by the time that they get into, say, 10th or 11th or 12th grade, they know what they're vaping and they've switched to nicotine. So, or perhaps they never knew it was nicotine, but now they do know it's nicotine. And those percentages are extremely disturbing.
Well, I have to say that obviously knowledge is a big part of trying to stop this problem. But in the last year, let's face it, what's dominated the conversation across the country has been, you know, the coronavirus. And we've had an election that gets a lot of news coverage. This, you know, these percentages, this growth in the use of vaping products may be a surprise to some. It's not, it seems as though it's not getting a lot of attention across the country, across the state. Now, Nikki, you just mentioned that in the schools and with working with your tobacco partners that it's getting some attention. But it seems as though that would be the key to trying to reduce the use in young people, is that they have to know what's going on. And I'll ask all three of you, how do we do that? How do we get that message across to kids and parents that this is not healthier than cigarette smoking and it's not healthy, period? Nikki, what about that?
Yeah, that's a great point. It, the awareness of the issue, you're totally right, has not really taken traction. There's a lot of social consequences. I think Brandy touched on that earlier, you know, with, you know, parents not being able to recognize devices, or perhaps parents themselves thinking it's safer. You know, the origins of vaping devices really started with trying to get adults off of nicotine or as a nicotine replacement, as a cessation tool. So, you know, I don't think any of us could have really imagined how that was going to impact our youth at the time, you know, when those devices became more popular in the cessation world. So one thing that we've been working on, and certainly the American Heart Association is extremely committed to, actually I'm the mission chair for our local board of directors in Lebanon County, and vaping has become one of our mission priorities at the American Heart Association. And so one of the things, you know, in recent years, a lot of students who are caught vaping, they get sort of punitive consequences. Maybe they get detention, or they're expelled from school, they're not expelled from school, but, you know, they get, sometimes they get fined. And Brandy can probably speak more to this. But one of the things that we're working on with schools right now here in Lebanon County is really trying to get schools to look closely at their vaping policy and their smoking policy and create an avenue for kids to get into cessation programs or education programs. A lot of these programs are provided for free by the tobacco coalition providers, the American Lung Association, the American Heart Association is putting a lot of effort into this, so that students are then adjudicated to these programs where they learn more about vaping and they learn about the effects on their body. You know, and certainly perhaps more educational materials are sent home with students to the parents, or when the parents are notified that the students were caught with a vaping device, at that point, the school can make an effort to educate the parents, which I think some of that is already happening, but we could be putting more kids into educational programs. And that's something we are definitely working towards here in Lebanon County.
Brandy Sheeler, how do we
cut through? I 100% agree with you.
Yeah.
Sorry, Scott. I was just saying I 100% agree with everything that Nikki said. And I think having these conversations like we're having now, especially in conjunction with WellSpan, will really help us create sort of these touch points. So you're getting the information from your pediatrician and your family doctor. You're getting the information from your school. You're getting information from other community partners. And I think we can't get in front of kids enough to do this education piece, and it has to start young. We're not immune in Red Lion. We have students that have been found with vaping devices in our elementary schools. So we can't pretend like it's only a secondary problem or a middle school or senior high problem. We need to address it, you know, at the lower grades as well.
Dr. Russo.
Scott, this is the wonderful, wonderful things that have been added so far. You know, I do want to say, you know, WellSpan, we support the Pennsylvania Academy of the Pennsylvania chapter of the Academy of Pediatrics, which recently had outlined their blueprint for legislative advocacy. And one of their goals that they have stated is to really protect young people from vaping and e-cigarette products through regulations of these products, particularly these child-friendly products, to really get those off the market and really feel, how can we make effective laws that reduce access to these things for youth, and also to expand smoking cessation and techniques, things that have been talked about. But, you know, also, you know, just to mention, I really appreciate that, you know, WellSpan as a really trying to see themselves as the trusted healthcare provider for parents and families, that this is a discussion which has to be had in the office. And if we as providers can have these discussions and guide parents how to have these discussions, and this dovetails with the wonderful work that's being, occurring in our schools, then I think we have a very consistent message to tell children about the dangers of this.
Dr. Christopher Russo is Director of Pediatrics, Women and Children's Services, and Medical Director for Quality and Innovation at WellSpan Health. Brandi Sheeler is a school social worker at Red Lion Area Senior High School. And Nikki Maurer is Executive Director of the Community Health Council of Lebanon County. Thank all three of you for being with us today. Hopefully, a lot of people take some messages away from some good information from our discussion today. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Visits to Pennsylvania's historic sites were one of the many casualties of the coronavirus pandemic last spring. There's good news, though. Those who enjoy witnessing Pennsylvania's history where it happened, well, they opened up. The historic sites opened up. Pennsylvania state-owned historic sites and museums opened to the public last Friday. Andrea Lowry is the Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Historical and Museum Commission, and she joins us now. Ms. Lowry, welcome to the program. How was visitation at the historic sites across the state over the weekend?
Good morning, Scott. Well, thanks for having us. It was great. We opened our doors, as you said, on Friday at the State Museum of Pennsylvania here in Harrisburg and our 25 historic sites and museums across the Commonwealth. We saw very nice crowds come through. Everybody was, I think, felt welcome and safe. And so we're excited to be back in business.
You know, a full year of not being able to visit many of these sites. What was going on during that year of not being able to visit the sites or them not being open?
So we were extremely busy. Our sites and museums out in the field that have grounds certainly were open for passive visitation. But you're right, our buildings were not open to the public. And during that time, we really looked to our virtual programming to connect with people. And that really blossomed over the last year. We had a number of programs, both at the State Museum and our historic sites. We had popular programs where we had hundreds of visitors attend to hear about the history of the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic and topics like whiskey distilling, archaeology, natural history. So we really connected with people through that platform. We also have been putting our collections online. So we have more than 13,000 of our artifacts now online. So you don't actually have to be in person to visit our collections. And we've also done a lot of planning. We're working on a master plan to revitalize the State Museum.
Revitalize it in what way?
So for those of you who are familiar with the State Museum, it was constructed in 1962 to 64, and it has 160,000 square feet of gallery space, and explores Pennsylvania's culture and cultural and natural history. And because of the size of the building, when they opened, not all the exhibits were completed at one time. Several of those exhibits have not been updated recently. And so we're looking at how to better meet visitor expectations for the 21st century and provide visitor amenities, as well as telling a more complete Pennsylvania story, whether that's, you can walk out of the State Museum right now without really understanding who William Penn or Benjamin Franklin were necessarily in a really holistic way. And there are tales that we don't tell, the Great Migration and its effect here in Pennsylvania. So looking to diversify the stories that we tell, really putting people in the museum and making it a more compelling experience. So we'll be doing things like adding elevators and upgrading the exhibits over the coming years.
Well, I have to say, just from a personal point of view, that a visit to the State Museum of Pennsylvania should be a must for all Pennsylvanians, so that we can learn about our heritage, learn about our history. And it's good to hear that there will be some changes going on. It sounds as if a silver lining, if you will, maybe not one that you wanted, but there was a silver lining as part of the last year when some of the facilities and the buildings were not open. I have to ask Andrea. I'm sure there are still some people who are wondering about the safety of making these visits. What can you tell would-be visitors about that?
So we are making sure that visitors are being welcomed back in a safe way. Everyone is masking and social distancing. We have reduced our hours to some degree. For example, the State Museum is open Wednesday to Saturday, 9 to 3, and Sunday from noon to 3 to allow us to do enhanced cleaning. And what we saw from visitation, both at the State Museum and at the sites over the weekend, was that people felt very safe. Everyone was complying with the masking and social distancing requirements, and things were smooth.
Mm-hmm. Was there one site that stuck out as far as visitation?
We saw numbers around, I believe, a little over 100 at the State Museum on Saturday. So there was definitely a lot of visitation there. We've got a couple of exhibits open that opened just before the pandemic related to the role of women in the history of Pennsylvania. People came out to see those. One of the two exhibits that's open right now is Game Changers, which was previously the residence and celebrates Pennsylvania women from the last century who've made important change at the state or national level. And another is Why Not in Pennsylvania, which is an exhibit about the role of Pennsylvania in the women's suffrage movement. And you'll see stories there of women associated with suffrage who are common household names. You know, Alice Hall, who we claim is a Pennsylvanian, having gone to Swarthmore and University of Pennsylvania. But you'll also find stories about lesser known Pennsylvanians like Kate Heffelfinger, who was an art student from Shamokin who joined Alice Paul on the picket lines outside the White House and participated with Paul in the hunger strikes and was one of the first women to run for statewide office in Pennsylvania after the 19th Amendment was ratified.
Just so much history, and it is so fascinating. Again, I would say anyone who is looking to learn more about Pennsylvania and its history, visit the State Museum or any of these historic sites. Had nice weather this weekend. Weather's getting warmer. More people going out as they're getting vaccinated. Andrea Lowry, the Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Historical Museum Commission, thank you very much for being with us today. And let's hope that we can get back to some normalcy. I don't know if we'll ever get back to totally pre-pandemic normal, but some normalcy with the historic sites in Pennsylvania. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. Have a great day.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.